You know the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah.
This is WBCR LP 97.7 on your FM dial, broadcasting from downtown Great Barrington in the Berkshire Hills of Western Massachusetts. That was The Doors. And this is Mickey Friedman. And this is The Other Side. There are, of course, many sides and many truths. This show is about some of the other sides of the story. My pick of the many stories out there. On September 15th, 2005, the Bring Them Home Now tour came to Amherst, Massachusetts. The Trap Rock Peace Center recorded their press conference. Elliot Adams served in the infantry as a paratrooper in Vietnam. He is a member of Veterans for Peace and Fellowship of Reconciliation.
I went to Crawford because of my experience watching my fellow vets go through the pain and of trying to put their lives back again after they came back from Nam. I watched as they committed suicide. I watched as they beat up their wives. I recognize that when you send men to war, it's like taking a crystal glass and breaking it. You don't know how to put it back together again. So rather than looking for new glues, what I feel we need to do is not break anymore, and just not send any more vets out there, to not create any more new vets. The pain that I watched happened, you're all a fairly young group. You may not be aware that more of my compatriots, more of the guys I served with, have committed suicide since they came back from Vietnam than died in Vietnam. Many of you have talked to World War II or have known World War II vets who never spoke a word about it to the day they died. That wasn't because they came back whole and had a great time. I was recently doing a workshop, and a woman who was in the workshop broke down in tears. And as we worked through it, we realized she was struggling with growing up in an abusive household. And during the workshop, she realized the abuse started when her father came home from Korea. The prices are so high that I felt compelled to do whatever I can. What's one man's life worth? What's one human being's life worth? So it was worth a great deal of my effort to try to see if we can bring them home a little sooner, maybe say even one or two, and hopefully we will carry this message and not only bring them home, but not send them out again. We should keep them. This sending our boys out to die for imperialistic efforts is wrong and immoral. So the message we're bringing from Crawford is bring them home now, take care of them when they get here, and don't ever send them out on a lie again.
Stacy Bannerman's husband served in Iraq with the Washington State National Guard. She is a member of Military Families Speak Out.
I'm on the Bring Them Home Now tour because it's clear to at least 60% of the people in this country, it's clear to 60% of the people in this country that this is a war based on lies. Americans want the troops home. And I think that we've seen in the Gulf region now with Hurricane Katrina why it's especially important that we're bringing the Guard and Reservists home and that we're not using them to fight overseas wars in the way that we are right now. Over half of the troops in Iraq are National Guard and Reserves. I mean, this administration and, frankly, the military clearly is lying to the soldiers when they're recruiting them and when they're signing them up. You know, I know that the active duty component isn't always getting a fair deal either. I know that this administration has broken its promises to this nation's veterans and their families. I am on the Bring Them Home Now tour to see that we are supporting our troops, to see that we're taking care of them when they get home, and to see to it that this nation does not continue its history and its record of sending soldiers into harm's way for lies. When my husband was called to serve in the largest ever deployment of citizen soldiers in this nation's history, you know, he was almost toward the end of his 20-year contract. He should have been able to leave, but they don't allow the guys that signed up for 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks a year, to leave when their contracts are over. They don't give them the same medical benefits as active duty soldiers. They don't give them the same training and equipment and support. The military has got what is called a tiered resourcing system. And what that means is that when they get equipment and supplies in, those things filter down top to bottom. And who's on the bottom in the military structure? The weekend warriors, the Army National Guard. And they're the ones who have literally been sent into this war with Vietnam-era flak jackets held together by duct tape and dental floss. Is this the best that this administration can do? They tell me that when I speak out, I'm not supporting the troops? Please. My husband, our families, these men at this table, they are the troops. Maybe if this administration had their own loved ones in harm's way. Maybe if the warmongers in this country had themselves not avoided serving, maybe they wouldn't be so quick to send our troops to war for oil.
Michael Hoffman is a founding member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. He was a Lance Corporal with the 1st Marine Division in Iraq from March to May 2003.
Probably like so many of you, a few years ago, I was trying to figure out what I was doing, what I was going to do with the rest of my life. I graduated from high school, and there weren't a lot of opportunities in front of me. I didn't have the grades to go to school. Both my parents were working class. My dad was a steel worker. So it really wasn't any money for me to go to college without some form of scholarship. There weren't a lot of job opportunities for me either. The area I'm from, Allentown, Pennsylvania, is basically going into the same kind of industrial depression the rest of the country's in. The main employers, places like the Bethlehem Steel, which is now bankrupt where my father worked, or Air Products, which is moving out of the area, or Mack Trucks that went to Mexico after NAFTA was signed, weren't there to employ my generation. So like so many of my friends that didn't go on to college, I was left wondering what I was going to do, which led me to start working a series of dead-end jobs like just about every single 18, 19-year-old that's trying to make his way in the world. I did that for about a year and a half until a Marine Corps recruiter approached me and said, "Why are you wasting your life here? You know, you're bright, you've got potential, you should join the Marines and put that potential to good use." He talked about what I get from the Marine Corps. I get a regular paycheck, 3 square meals a day, a roof over my head, health insurance, job training, money for school, which I think I said already. And then on top of all that, I get to travel the world and protect my country. Great. Where do I sign up? When I first signed up, the big thing in the news was the war in the Balkans. I wanted to go over there and help people. That's what I saw the military as. I saw the military the way I had seen it all through high school. You know, the basic things we're taught in school, we see through the news, is that the military, our government, when they get involved, they do it to help. They do it for the greater good. And that's what I thought. That's why I wanted to go to the Balkans. I wanted to help end the genocide that we were seeing in the news. Luckily, though, by the time I finished boot camp and my training, that was basically coming to an end. So instead, I ended up doing the basic 4-year peacetime routine with the U.S. Marines. So So fast forward to December of 2002, I thought I was out. I thought I was home free. My time was up. I'd served honorably. I was ready to go home. But unfortunately, that's not what the Marine Corps had in store for me. 2 days before I was supposed to be discharged, the first stop-loss order of this Gulf War was signed, and I was told I wasn't going home. I was instead going to Iraq with the rest of my unit. In February of 2003, my unit was deployed to Kuwait in anticipation of the invasion. And then on March 20th of that year, I crossed the border into Iraq with the 1st Marine Division Invasion Force. While serving in Iraq with an artillery battery, I saw things that no human being should ever have to see and ever have to be part of. My unit was shooting anywhere from 500 to 600 rounds a day. That's each round weighing over 100 pounds of high explosive. That's an amazing amount of firepower we were wielding against the people of Iraq, a basically defenseless people with no real military. What little military they had been crushed in the Gulf War, and what was left was incredibly demoralized and incredibly under-equipped. Most Iraqi forces fled rather than fight us. We saw roads stretched for miles with Iraqi troops that simply deserted instead of fighting the Americans. But while we pushed forward, I saw what we did. I saw Iraqi towns burning to the ground. I saw bodies, civilian and military, just lining the side of the road. I remember seeing American vehicles riddled with bullet holes and a pool of blood in each seat and wondering, did that Marine survive? Was that one of my friends? Did I know that person? And probably the worst thing I had to experience while I was there, is I had to find out what burning bodies smell like. I've talked to World War II vets, and it's the exact same things they remember when they found the death camps outside of Germany in World War II, and they still remember that to this day. And that's what myself and my friends are left with. And we come home faced with the knowledge that this was all for a lie. The ties to Al-Qaeda were lies. The weapons of mass destruction were lies. And it's myself and my friends who have to pay the price for this. It's the people of Iraq who have to pay the price for this. And we will be dealing with this for the rest of our lives. And that's why we formed Iraq Veterans Against the War, to make sure that no one else has to go over there and face what we've come face to face with. And also to make sure that another generation does not have to go through what we've gone through. I don't want to have children and have to worry about them going through what I've gone through in another 20, 30 years, that they have to go back to the Middle East and fix the problems that we created with this war.
Far between sundown's finish and midnight's broken tone, we duck inside the doorway, thunder crashing. As majestic bells of bolts struck shadows in the sound, seeming to be the chimes of freedom flashing. Flashing for the warriors whose strength is not to fight. Flashing for the refugees on the unarmed road of flight. And for each and every underdog soldier in the night. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing. Even though a cloud's white curtain in a far off corner flashed, and the hypnotic splattered mist was slowly lifting. Electric lights still struck like arrows, fired but for the ones condemned to drift or else be kept from drifting. Tolling for the searching ones on their speechless seeking trail. For the lonesome-hearted lovers with two personal tales.
inside a jail, and we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing. Track of hours, for they hang suspended. As we listen one last time, and we watch with one last look, spellbound and swallowed till the tolling ended. Tolling for the aching ones whose wounds cannot be nursed. Confused, accused, misused, strung out ones and worse. And for every hung up person in the whole wide universe, and we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing.
Patient at one of Baghdad's only two mental hospitals has left a keen and sob in her barren room. There are no sheets on the iron bedstead. There's no sign of any staff. A relative sits outside watching TV. She's been handed the keys to the ward. There are only a handful of patients in the entire 70-bed hospital. Psychiatrist Dr. Bahir Bhutti says it's not because Iraqis have suddenly found sanity.
Why should a patient come from a far area, paying a lot of money, and he comes to the hospital and gets, let's say, 20 tablets? Nobody gives him time, nobody talks to him, no other kind of services.
Drugs are either too expensive for his patients to purchase, or they're simply unavailable altogether. 44-year-old Dr. Bhutti says there are now perhaps 20 psychiatrists in Baghdad, a city of 6 million. He loves his work, and after the fall of Saddam, he dreamt of creating the country's first women's health center that would also have a mental health component. But foreign NGOs who promised help have fled the country. The Ministry of Health has changed hands, and he has no support now that officials there are supporters of radical Islamist Muqtada Sadr.
Our society as a whole is very undeveloped and retarded regarding mental health in general and regarding the women's role and rights. So it became a kind of a multi-layer suffering.
One of his patients with postpartum depression recently killed her baby and tried to commit suicide after her family cut off treatment. Citing the need for her at home, they decided treatment wasn't worth it. Security concerns have compounded ignorance, dramatically decreasing the number of women Dr. Bhutti now sees.
They are not able to come to seek help. They're not able to leave their houses and come and seek help.
His wife is also a doctor. He worries she could be kidnapped. Her clinic has been mortared. Their 8-year-old daughter was seriously injured in a bombing last May. And while the U.S. military says the number of attacks is down, he sees no improvement in their neighborhood of Dora. As insurgents increasingly target Shiites, shadowy groups respond against the Sunnis. He says this is beginning to take its toll on mixed marriages. He has a patient who is a Sunni. His wife is Shiite.
It was just yesterday that I had someone who said that I'm having a sectarian problem. I asked him, do you have a problem with the wife? He said, it's not my wife herself, it's her family. I mean, we didn't used to have such a problem.
The early hours of the morning, and the full fury of the U.S. military unleashed in the heartland of Iraq's insurgency. The Americans are calling this their biggest offensive in the area this year. It's an all-out assault on an elusive enemy, blamed for killing soldiers and Iraqi civilians in a campaign of bombings. Around-the-clock operation filmed here by an embedded American television crew. House-to-house raids continued after daybreak, and the Americans aren't knocking on doors. They're blasting their way into homes. The gloves are well and truly off. And everyone's a suspect, no matter their age. Everyone a potential insurgent. This isn't likely to win the Americans friends in an area that's become more and more dangerous for them. And it's dangerous, too, for civilians now. These are the men the Americans are after in the town of Ramadi this week. In much of western Iraq, it's militants in charge, imposing an often brutal rule. U.S. forces have come for them before, but when they've pulled out, the armed men are back. This time, the Americans have been blowing up bridges to prevent them fleeing into the desert. But there have been civilian casualties. In a hospital near the Syrian border, the body of a child. No one knows how many others there may be. Doctors say they're asking for ambulances to be allowed to go and retrieve the injured and the dead. From the ruins, the Americans hope to at least put a dent in the insurgency. But this isn't a fight that favors a conventional army. And with the countdown now underway to a referendum on the new constitution in just 10 days' time, U.S. officials are predicting a new wave of attacks. Tonight, the bombers struck again south of Baghdad. The target was a Shiite mosque, crowded at the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan. Caroline Hawley, BBC News, Baghdad.
Carlos Arredondo's son, Alexander, served with the Marines in Iraq and was killed on August 25, 2004. After learning that his son had died, Mr. Arredondo smashed the window of the Marines' van, got in, and set the van on fire. He is now a member of Gold Star Families for Peace.
Well, thank you for allowing me to join this group of people who are doing a great job. Also, I want to thank everyone for taking the time to be here. I'm a Gold Star family. I'm here, part of the military family, speak out, and like the lady say here, this is my first time. And why to join now and not then? Well, I'm the father who, when the news came to my house, totally everything went wrong, if I can say that, in my part. I've been healing all this time. You know, I'm still seeing the doctor. I have 26% of burning in my body because at the time when they show up at my house and they come to my house and give me the news of my son was got killed. I wasn't prepared at all. You know, they took my son, they prepared him for war, they exhaust him, they make him endure, and you know, he was totally wanted to do this. And I was supporting him. As a father, I only can tell him so much. When he first told me that he was going to join the Marine, I said, oh, no, Alexander, I don't want you to come in a body bag. And he was so sure that wouldn't happen to him because we have this powerful nation, this powerful military, and wasn't like that. And he said, Dad, don't worry, it's not going to happen to me. Unfortunately, it happened. I wasn't prepared myself. And it's a quite a story since all this started. Affect my family, my friends, and a lot of people around me. A lot of people who send me a letter and they say, I will do the same thing as you did if it was me. Other people was upset and angry about it. In my case, it's when the way it went. Was no scripts like a Hollywood. Was no way back. No way back. Alexander was very honorable. When he grew up in Jamaica Plain, I am the father who coming from Costa Rica and crossed Nicaragua during the Civil War there, and the father who crossed the border with Arizona as a legal alien and come to this country for the American dream. Alexander and his brother Brian was my American dream. And that dream was shattered when those Marines show up at my house. It's few you people know what happened there. It's get affects in everybody. Everybody get affected. In my case, my family, we are losers in this war. We already lost Alex. And I'm happy for the people of Iraq who getting this together. We lost, they have a car bomb yesterday, 136 people got killed right there in the market. But they're going to find out very soon, and with the help of everybody, we're going to bring the truth back home very soon. Because it hurt me a lot every time I turn the TV and I see another casualty, you know? Back then it was so difficult and worried for my son that he's there, you know? And why all this come to this end? Because when I first support my son, because everybody, who doesn't here support the sons? I support my son all the way. I only can tell him so much. And then support him. He went along, like some people say, we know all the lights. And in my case, I had two TVs watching all these things, people being blamed. And so I get polluted too much. I've been watching two TVs, listening to NPR and all this news. And then the structure went down. And for Christ, my son is coming back and everybody else. Then, you know, then we seen this F-18 plane landing in the aircraft carrier, this big sign saying, mission accomplished. Oh, wow, what excitement in my case. What excitement. They're coming back now. Wow, my American dream, my son, my best friend, you know, he's coming back. But then I feel betrayed because none of this happened. There's still people getting killed up there. You know? And that annoyed me. And it started building my blood, you know, accumulating all this. You know? It's hard enough for me. I have to translate everything in TV to my computer here in Spanish to figure out later. Oh! You know, so it's really difficult for a lot of families. It's been very difficult. I've been a year and a month through all this ordeal already. And families who already been through this situation, they know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, everyone, it's very difficult. It's very, very difficult. I'm seeing a psychiatric who putting me together right now. I'm seeing a consul, this center in Boston, who is a wonderful person. He's been helping me around. The reason I'm here, because I'm getting myself together, thank God, you know, but it's a far road ahead of me, you know. And I haven't been able to say anything. All this happened before Cindy Sheehan. Nobody was up there. But when I hear about Cindy Sheehan, I say, oh my God, I gotta go there. I gotta go there. And I was driving to Florida, a car for a customer. I cannot, 95 is going that way. I'm trying to turn on 10. But, you know, responsibility don't make me go there. But, you know, I'm here. And, you know, I want to do something about it. Because I feel betrayed. I did feel betrayed. And I'm very angry about it. And it's something that I just learned not too long ago. It's impeachment? I hear that name, you know? Yeah.
Thank you.
And I'm here because I feel that I need to support this. In my family, myself and my family, we're going to support Cindy Sheehan, these wonderful people that I met today, and I'm going to support them and do what I can. I'm not here. Hopefully, you know, I don't be insulting anybody. Everybody got their own opinion. But if I can make a difference, I would like to help on it. And I want those troops to come back home because enough is enough. And I don't seek to see the president. That would be Cindy Sheehan's job. But I will tell to somebody, perhaps in this chain, to ask the president, it's not what the country can do for you, Mr. President. It's what you can do for the country. So bring the truth back now.
Yeah.
Because I'm getting tired of turning TV and seeing more family getting broken.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
seeking trail for the lonesome hearted lover, the two person of a tale. Reach on.
Captain Kennedy?
Yes, Mr. President.
Well, it's good to see you. Thanks. Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to allow me to visit with you a little bit. I got some questions for you here in a minute, but I do want to share some thoughts with you. First, I want to thank the members of the 42nd Infantry Division and Task Force Liberty for serving our country with such distinction and honor. I want you to know that the mission you are on is vital to achieving peace and to protecting America.
Why did the administration feel it was necessary to coach the soldiers that the president talked to this morning in Iraq?
I'm sorry, I don't know what you're suggesting.
Well, they discussed the questions ahead of time. They were told exactly what the president would ask, and they were coached in terms of who would answer what question and how they would pass the microphone.
I'm sorry, sir. Are you suggesting that what our troops were saying was not sincere, or that what they said was not their own thoughts?
Not at all. I'm just asking why it was necessary to coach them.
Well, in terms of the event earlier today, the event was set up to highlight an important milestone in Iraq's history and to give the president an opportunity to once again express our appreciation for all that our troops are doing when it comes to defending freedom and their courage and their sacrifice. And this is a satellite feed, as you are aware, and there are always technological challenges involved when you're talking with troops on a satellite feed like this. And I think that we worked very closely with the Department of Defense to coordinate this event, and I think all they were doing was talking to the troops and letting them know what to expect.
You specifically this morning if there would be any screening of questions or if they were being told in any way what they should say or do, and you indicated no.
I don't think that's what the question was earlier today. I think the question earlier today was asking if they could ask whatever they want. I said, of course. The president was, and you saw earlier today, the president was trying to engage in a back and forth with the troops, and I think it was very powerful what Lieutenant Murphy was saying at the end of that conversation when he was talking about what was going on in January, how the American troops and coalition forces were in the lead when it came to providing security for the upcoming election, an election where more than 8 million Iraqis showed up and voted. It was a great success. And he talked about how this time, when we have the preparations for the upcoming referendum this Saturday, you have Iraqi forces that are in the lead, and the Iraqi forces are the ones that are doing the planning and preparing and taking the lead to provide for their own security as they get ready to cast their ballots again.
But I also asked this morning, were they being told by their commanders what to say or what to do, as you indicated, no? Was there any pre-screening?
I'm not aware of any such activities that were being undertaken. We coordinated closely with the Department of Defense. You can ask if there's any additional things that they did, but we work very closely with them to coordinate these events, and the troops can ask the president whatever they want.
First on Fox, there is late word tonight that they are hot at the Pentagon over what happened just before the taping of the video next to me. At least one senior military official tells Fox News that he is livid over the handling of U.S. troops in Iraq before their talk by satellite with the president live on Fox News and elsewhere. As the White House tries to prop up support for an increasingly unpopular war, today to hear it from military brass, it used soldiers as props on stage. One commander tells Fox it was scripted and rehearsed. The troops were told what to say to the president and how to say it, and that, says another senior officer today, is outrageous. It's certainly not the first time a photo op has been staged for the president, far from it, but it's the first time we know of that such a staging has touched off such anger. Team Fox coverage now. Brett Baer at the Pentagon. First, Carl Cameron at the White House. Carl.
Shep, there's lots of frustration across the Bush administration about this one. The president had wanted to boost the troops in advance of the referendum on the Iraqi Constitution this coming Saturday and brace them for what many expect will be an uptick in insurgent violence.
We're never going to back down. We're never going to give in. We'll never accept anything less than total victory.
There were a host of mixed messages today on a variety of fronts. First, about that insurgent violence. The State Department said it may be decreasing, but the administration sent a report to Congress saying the average number of weekly attacks has risen in the run-up to the referendum vote. The latest Fox News Opinion Dynamics poll puts the president's job approval rate at a new low of 40%. And 36% believe the U.S. is more committed to winning the war on terror than Muslim radicals, but an equal number of Americans think the Muslim radicals are more committed. And there were mixed messages about the president's teleconference. First, the White House and the Pentagon claimed it was not rehearsed. But for 45 minutes before the event, the hand-picked soldiers practiced their answers with a Pentagon official via satellite from D.C., who, in her own words, quote, drilled them on the president's likely questions and their, quote, scripted responses.
So when you introduce yourself, when
you
say, and when you say, Captain Kennedy, and where you're from, and say, and to my right is Master Sergeant Akil from the Iraqi forces. Sir, together we are working on.
Okay.
How's that?
No, that's fine.
All right, let me throw the question to you one more time.
And you heard it late this afternoon, Pentagon officials calling the apparent coaching outrageous. And there are folks here at the White House now walking around shaking their heads at how badly it appears to have gone, Chuck.
I bet they are.
Patrick Resta served in Iraq as a medic with the North Carolina National Guard from March to November 2004. He is now the Northeastern and New England Coordinator for Iraq Veterans Against the War.
We have an effort within the military to link Iraq and September 11th. And that's an even more dangerous way to allow the enemy to be dehumanized to the degree and beyond the degree that the Vietnamese people were in the Vietnam War. And as kind of an illustration, I'll tell you about my first 3 hours in Iraq. We arrived at my base. We'd only been there about 2 hours. We get attacked for the first time. There's five men firing AK-47s and rocket-propelled grenades and advancing on our camp, trying to get inside the wire. And these guys were really well-trained. I think a lot of people have the perception that it's, 16-year-old kids in sandals firing AK-47s at us from alleys. And it's not. It's people that are very well-trained and have military backgrounds. As this is occurring, a car is flying down this dirt road that dead-ends into our camp. And all the locals knew not to use this road. Now this car, and this is at about 2 in the morning that this is happening. Now this car is throwing up showers of sparks from it. They look just like the rocket-propelled grenades being fired into our base. So there's about 40 soldiers out there getting a tour of our base. And one of the lieutenants orders a machine gunner to fire in front of this car to get it to stop. Now, these 40 soldiers have been hearing for 6 months, there's no such thing as a warning shot. When you shoot to kill. So they think that this machine gunner is shooting at this car. So they all open fire in this car. At one point, even the cannon on an armored personnel carrier was firing at this car. The car stops after it was hit 23 times. They send a team of soldiers out there to get what they think are going to be prisoners and dead bodies. And what they find is scrap metal that these people had taken to salvage tied to the roof so long that it was coming down over the hood and the trunk and scraping on the ground, and that's what was throwing up these sparks. And these people had just taken a wrong turn and were in the wrong place at the wrong time. It was a 12-year-old boy and two men in their 40s, and they're literally thrown into the back of this armored personnel carrier, driven up to our clinic. The first guy that's dragged in, a gentleman in his 40s, had been shot 6 times, twice in his left chest, right above his heart. The other 4 went into his femur, shattered his femur, and that whole side of his pelvis. And he was a big guy, probably weighed about 250 pounds. He's dragged in on a mesh mat, basically. And this is one of the many images that I'll have in my head forever. He's dragged in, and the soldier that drags him in is still bent over. He's got a cigarette in his mouth, and his M16 is strapped across his back. And he laughs, and he says, "I guess this piece of expletive sand, expletive, is yours now." And turns around and walks down the hallway, laughing hysterically. And this guy is laying on the floor, bleeding out. So we treat these two guys and get them on helicopters. And I walk outside to start smoking again. First time I smoked in something like 8 years. And I'm out there smoking, and I see this guy in my company keeps bending down and picking things up off the ground. And I walk over to him and ask him what he's doing. And he holds up an empty shell casing, brass, from one of the rounds he fired. And he's picking them all up. And he tells me he's going to make a bracelet out of it, out of the rounds he had fired into this car. And this was well after he knew that they were civilians, that they were innocent people that had just been shot. And he proceeded to call his mother, call other family members, write letters home, tell anybody that would listen, any other soldier that would listen, how proud he was of what he had done. And it was like he had just shot his first deer. And he wore this bracelet of all these rounds he had fired for the entire time we were in Iraq. And whenever he would travel anywhere and people would ask him about it, he would tell them why he was wearing it. And I think a lot of people are over there with that mindset. They think this is about religion and this is about revenge for September 11th.
Summer has come and passed. The innocent can never last. Wake me up when September ends. Like my father's come to pass, 7 years has gone so fast. Wake me up when September ends. Here comes the rain again, falling from the stars, drenched in my pain again, becoming who we are. As my memory rests, but never forgets what I lost, wake me up when September ends.
Yeah. The innocent can never last. Wake me up when September ends. Like my father's come to pass. 20 years has gone.
My aunt and uncle were killed on September 11th, and I was I'm in the National Guard, as he said, and I was deployed 3 weeks after that as part of the so-called Homeland Security, and we were sent to an Army base in South Carolina, and our mission was to guard this base. Before September 11th, anyone could just drive on. There was no guards checking ID or vehicles or anything like that. So here we were guarding this base less than a month after September 11th with empty weapons. We had no ammunition, in our rifles, on us, anywhere that we could get to it. And then when the anthrax letters started coming out, there was this huge, everyone going crazy. Oh, we have to get ready to defend this base in case it's attacked by chemical or biological weapons. So here I am with two other medics running around doing this training, and I don't even have a filter for my gas mask. And I remember looking at the guy that's supervising this training and telling him, well, if I show up somewhere, I might as well just jump on the pile because I'm going to be dead too. And just, laughing about it. And, what a joke it was. And then, we couldn't get bandages or IV fluid even. We could not, never mind the drugs we would need to treat people that had been affected. And this is in South Carolina. This is in the United States. It's not in Iraq. It's not in Kuwait. So that really opened my eyes to what has been going on since September 11th. I was there for a year, had about a year off, found out I was getting deployed again, this time to Iraq, and I had 36 hours notice that I was being sent to Iraq. I arrived there for a month. I sat in the barracks staring at the wall every day from 9 to 5 and did nothing, had absolutely no training. The training, if you want to call it that I received was 2 days. The first day I went, it was handed a rifle, gas mask, went down to the range, tested these things, went back to turn them back in, and I was told that I had been given someone else's rifle. So basically what that means is I had taken it down to the range, taken it off of their settings, and put it on mine. So whoever this rifle belonged to, when they needed it to shoot, it wouldn't shoot at what they were aiming at. It wouldn't shoot straight, basically. So I tell the armorer, that's fine. Just let him know. Just give me another rifle, and I'll go back down to the range. Oh, that's not possible. All this stuff has to be down at the port in the morning. It's got to be put on a ship to get sent over there. So I went through my entire tour in Iraq with a weapon I never even set the sights on, a weapon I never even fired once, a gas mask that did not even fit me. So in other words, I'm going into this environment where supposedly there are all these weapons of mass destruction, but they're perfectly fine with sending me in there with a gas mask that doesn't even fit. And this is not just something that happened to me alone. This has happened to thousands and thousands of soldiers that have gone over there, and it's cost a lot of them their lives. I'd take out a loan to buy my own body armor and some other equipment. When we actually got to Kuwait, and went out to our vehicles to cross the border, they were nailing half-inch sheets of plywood to canvas doors on the Humvees and then spray-painting them green so they would, quote, look like metal, unquote. And the rationale was that, well, if someone sees this plywood spray-painted green, they're going to think it's metal. They'll think this has been reinforced, and they'll shoot at another vehicle and not yours. So I'm walking down this line of hundreds of vehicles taking pictures of all this stuff. And towards the end, there's a Humvee with kind of like a pickup truck, an open bed in the back. And they're standing up plywood and nailing it up. And I remember the guy holding up a can of spray paint. It was black spray paint, and he was shaking, and he said, "This is high gloss, so when the sun hits it, it'll really look like metal." You know, and here are all these soldiers just staring at each other and staring at these vehicles like this cannot be real. But it was. The next morning we crossed the border into Iraq. Outside of Baghdad, we had our first fatality. 28-year-old man named Hassalin Karaskia. He was killed by a roadside bomb. He was in a Humvee with a canvas door with a half-inch sheet of plywood attached to it. The roadside bomb went off and blew the left side of his head off and seriously injured the person in the passenger seat. And that's when it got real for a lot of us.
Amira al-Salami and her family live in one of Baghdad's big apartment blocks. She's a secondary school teacher, and her husband, Dr. Monjad al-Naib, works at the Ministry of Science and Technology, a middle-class family whose high hopes are all but extinguished.
It's bad, bad.
The al-Naib family expected America to change Iraq from dictatorship to democracy, to bring jobs and opportunity. What they never expected was the violence and mayhem that still rules their lives 2.5 years after the war and leaves little room for optimism.
It's very hard to say that because we don't know what will happen tomorrow, actually. It's very, very hard to say that because every situation now doesn't appear that there is a small light in this darkness.
It doesn't take long for Amira's pent-up tears to start flowing. I'm crying for Iraq. They destroyed its past and its future, she says. Now those dirty terrorists who come from outside want to destroy it completely. The frustration and hopelessness of the parents is filtering down to their children, the very generation of educated, secular, middle-class people Iraq's future depends on. 22-year-old Omar studies medical technology at university, but he's worried about finding a job.
The students who graduated from my college last year are still sitting at home waiting.
20-year-old Mohammed studies mathematics. Like his whole family and many of their friends, he wants to leave Iraq.
I want to ask you whether you could stay 5 or 10 years here. There is no reason for me to stay, no jobs, not even electricity or running water.
Indeed, 2.5 years after the war, basic services remain sporadic. This family's most treasured possession is still their small generator.
Check the oil is the most important thing.
Instead of having fun, going out to play sports and youthful clubbing, life for these young people is all about curfews, gasoline lines, roadblocks and explosions.
Me as a young man, I should live like young men in other countries who spend their nights out. But now I can't. My family starts calling me around 7:30 p.m. to come home.
This family, who hoped America would bring them a better future, was further shaken when Munjab says he was arrested 2 years ago by American forces and kept without charge for 50 days before being released. He says they were looking for weapons.
I don't know why they are punishing the people. What I have done to them, I don't know. Till now, I don't know why.
Munjad lodged a complaint with the U.S. military, but he's most afraid of the religious militias and the insurgents. Amira says she lives in constant fear, hovering at her balcony every day, waiting for her husband to come back from work, her children to return from school. Before, we used to visit our families, attend celebrations and go to restaurants. We walked about until late. What kind of life are we living now, just eating and drinking? Is this a life? Christiana Manpour, CNN, Baghdad.
You know the day destroys the night, night divides the day.
We heard audio from the Trap Rock Peace Center, NPR, BBC, C-SPAN, Fox News, and CNN. We heard The Chimes of Freedom by the Byrds, then Eliza Gilkison's version, and finally, Wake Me Up When September Ends by Green Day. When September ends, comes October. On October 25th, 2005, we learned that 2,000 Americans have lost their lives in Iraq. Previous episodes of The Other Side can be downloaded as MP3 files from the action page of iraqproject.org, iraqproject.org. The Other Side is now available as a podcast. You can find it in the special podcasting section at the iTunes store. We're under the news category. It's The Other Side by Mickey Friedman. If you hit subscribe, new programs will automatically be downloaded to your computer for future listening. You can send comments, suggestions, and criticism to Mickey@iraqproject.org. That's Mickey@iraqproject.org. This is WBCR-LP, 97.7 FM, Great Barrington, Massachusetts. This is Mickey Friedman, and this is The Other Side.